America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Are you planning to make a move? According to our guest, who's one of the true visionaries of our age, you can expect to have a lot of company, whether it's because of political instability, climate change, or political instability because of climate change, or just the desire for more opportunity elsewhere. Young people are poised to make their move, and current borders won't limit many of them in their pursuits. America needs more young people, but will we change policies to allow them in? Oh, this change will also reshuffle the deck within the United States. So where will people be moving here in the lower 48? We'll be exploring all of that today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Parag Khanna. He's been with us before. The book that we focused on last time was The Future is Asian. And he's got a new book, and he's written seven of them. He's a remarkable thinker about global issues, truly remarkable. This new book is called Move, and it's the first book to really talk about where we are going to go to survive climate change. The book has as a subtitle, The Forces Uprooting Us. How much greater are these forces in the wake of the pandemic, Parag?
Well, thank you so much for having me back on again. And these forces are more profound than ever before. And I know that we live in the moment and we view this lockdown as something of an extended reality, something that's, you know, sort of brought us into suspended animation. But the fact is that forces like political instability, regimes that are failing, states that are failing like Afghanistan, as well as the economic crisis, both at home and around the world, partially also as a result of the pandemic, but also high debt, the labor imbalances of aging societies that need young people, technological automation, climate change, the list goes on and on. But these five, six major drivers of human migration are absolutely in overdrive right now. So you can't really pretend or believe that the pandemic is the end of mobility, the end of migration. Certainly not. In many ways, we're going to have a hockey stick-like situation, and migration may well explode coming out of the pandemic.
It's remarkable that we're in a moment here in America where we're trying to deny certain people access to our country when, in fact, it is so clear to anybody who's looking at this objectively. We need more people in the United States for many types of jobs, and as you point out, not just high-tech jobs.
That is exactly right. One of the great misconceptions is that we should only have, you know, software engineers, coming into the country. But let's not forget that, you know, our farms are lacking in, you know, or in our agricultural sort of system is lacking in farmers because of border closures. The same thing happened in France with Romanians who couldn't make it, over the various borders to get to France in the growing season. And if you look at Naples, Italy, you know, the trash doesn't get collected because there's such a terrible immigration policy. And then let's most obviously and most profoundly and most sad is that during the pandemic, we didn't have enough nurses. And a lot of Americans died, you know, our excess mortality, if you want to call it that, and just needless death of people in nursing homes and hospitals because we didn't have the nurses to care for them and, you know, provide enough care. That's really tragic. And let's remember that while we characterize the last couple of years as a quote unquote lockdown, I want to remind everyone that American embassies and consulates were working overtime to actually beg and bribe nurses from around the world to abandon their countries and fly to America to take care of our people. So So let's always be clear that at all levels of the value chain, you do need the right composition of the workforce. And if Americans aren't going to do something, it doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done, because actually the pandemic taught us to appreciate essential services. And a lot of these things that we've taken for granted are essential services, and a lot of those jobs are done by immigrants.
Let's also talk about the fact that a lot of people say geography is destiny. You say, no, geography is not destiny. It's what we make of it. And you say that connectivity is destiny. Explain that concept.
Well, so actually, there are these ancient adages. Geography is destiny is one of them. And it kind of implies you're stuck where you are. You know, then there is demography is destiny, which is, basically the largest, most populous countries will be the most powerful, but aging countries are destined to sort of fade into the past. And I have added two kind of modifications. One is connectivity is destiny, because we invest a lot more in infrastructure, whether it's high-speed railways and airports or internet cables, than we do in political borders, and people often forget that. But the theme of this new book is mobility is destiny, because now we have all of these forces pushing and pulling us around the world, and we're going to use this connectivity to get around the world more efficiently, or where even if it's inefficient, there's certainly going to be a lot more mobility, so much so that you might even say that much of the human species may be forced to become more nomadic again. And that's one of the kind of arguments that I, or kind of scenarios that I test out in the book.
Oh, absolutely. You talk about going from coastal to inland, going from south to north. What are all of these pressures, and how much of them, as you told us that this book really profoundly deals with, relate to climate change?
You know, if we really take a historical perspective, and I won't go into the kind of whole 100,000-year history of human migration out of Africa and so forth, but obviously climate has always played a big role, because we settled into the kind of, what scientists call the climate niche. Most of the world population lives between 20 and 30 degrees north latitude. That's not an accident, right? It's because that's been the temperate climate that's most, sort of appropriate for agriculture and so on. But as that climate niche changes and shifts and moves because of the volatility of climate change today, people will also move. And, we are beholden. We live at the mercy of those elements. Sure, there are many people who live in cities with lots of air conditioning. I'm speaking to you right now from Singapore on the other side of the world, a tropical island where everyone has air conditioning and you couldn't survive without it. But that's not going to apply. There's only 5 million people who live here. We're talking about 8 billion people in the world right now, many of whom are exposed to the elements, whether it's heat waves and droughts and so on. So if you look at just the last couple of hundred years, it's economic migration and political migration that have played the largest role. But in the 21st century, there's no question that climate refugees are going to be the largest category of migrants in the world.
And what is that going to look like in the United States? As you know, we've been building a wall, and we have this notion that any open border is a bad border. Many in America do. And yet we've got many poor countries that reside right below us to the south. And we've also got a lot of great young people who are available to us if we took advantage of that, and we're going to need that. We can already see these shortages developing in so many areas, and then you've got the heat on top of it. What will that drive going forward as you see it?
That's exactly right. And, so people are coming from all directions, actually. If you look at, the composition of U.S. immigration, of course, the largest flow has come from Latin America. But actually the U.S. has, drawn huge numbers of Asians, for example. There's 25 million Asian Americans. I grew up as an Asian American, right? And Canada has become so attractive now as well. At times when you have populism in the United States, such as under the Trump administration, a lot of people say, well, I'll take my talents and skills to Canada, because instead of this sort of opaque paper-based system of hundreds of different regulations and forms to, eventually hopefully apply for a green card, your pathway to citizenship in Canada kind of begins the day your plane lands. So there is this competition to actually attract young people and to do so in a way that's most amenable and simple for them. And that's something that we're not appreciating in our immigration policy right now. But the data is very clear. The U.S. used to attract the same number of official migrants into the U.S. as the entire rest of the world, literally. Like, you know, all the sort of destination countries, the rich countries, the desirable countries. That's the appeal that America had. But that gap has shrunk considerably, right? The U.S. is no longer necessarily the destination of first choice. And all of this is happening at a time when the world population is plateauing. So that means there's really a finite number of, you know, the kind of young people that will comprise the next generation to choose from and to attract and appeal to. So we have to be, you know, we cannot be complacent whatsoever, to be honest. And especially with climate change, taking that into account, America does not fare as well in climate models as Europe or Canada, which obviously have a further northern latitude than we have. So if you combine the politics and the bad immigration policy and climate change, you have a situation where the U.S. really has to defend, you know, actively appeal to the world to defend its turf as the most desirable place to be.
I don't think many of us caught on to what you have stated in the book Move, and that is that Canada really wants to grow its population and is very welcoming. And it makes sense. They've got wide open tracks and they are to the northern tier. And as you point out, I know we did in another podcast focus on Duluth, Minnesota. There's going to be a lot of migration that takes place within a country like the United States. I find it interesting, Parag, that still to this day, people seem to be moving to places in America that are growing more and more uninhabitable, probably not able to get a mortgage or insure their property going forward, but they are still very desirable to so many.
It is one of the great ironies, and this has been pointed out no shortage of times, that, you know, Austin and Miami have been sort of the big winners from pandemic migration. But, of course, that's a short-term phenomenon because in the long run, you know, given the Texas sort of, you know, volatility of weather, the heat, the power grid failing, all that kind of stuff, you know, people probably won't stay there very long. It obviously has more to do with tax than anything else. And it is clear, you know, climate models do make fairly clear what are the livable geographies and these pockets. And those are the places that I call climate oases in the book. And the U.S. obviously still has plenty of climate oases, right? We're a huge country. So the fact that, you know, places like Miami and Austin and Southern California are in for a rough ride in terms of water supply and temperature, you know, doesn't mean that there aren't places for us to go. In fact, you know, we should look at this in the context of the infrastructure bill, the Build Back Better plan and so forth, because the way we do infrastructure right now is to simply have things be fought over in the House and the Senate according to kind of pork barrel priorities. But what you need to be doing is looking at the climate models, which tell you which places are going to be the most stable, such as the Great Lakes, you know, where you're not going to have a drought, obviously, and then to think about, you know, how to encourage people to move to these stable places so that they're not trapped in places where forest fires or, you know, hurricanes are always destroying their homes, and then focus infrastructure spending on those places so there's enough affordable housing and utilities and so forth. That's the right sequence. When, if you're going to spend a few trillion dollars, right, you might as well do it the right way. And what I really want to see is us to follow this sequence of climate, immigration, infrastructure.
The book is called Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Parag Khanna, one of the great thinkers on global issues, and he is our guest today. As you scan the world for geographies that have abundant fresh water, and that's something that you should touch upon further because it's so important, progressive governance, and that can attract talent. One of the places that you arrived at in the United States, and a lot of people might not know, except you just mentioned the Great Lakes, Michigan.
Yes, and again, one of the great ironies, because if I'm not mistaken, based on the most recent census data, Michigan has been forced to give up a congressional seat because its population has been declining. But I think I could give you a fairly safe money-back guarantee that, you know, 10 years from now, the population of Michigan will, in fact, have rebounded to some degree, certainly be larger than it is today, because people will have abandoned certain, you know, again, climatologically failing areas like, say, Louisiana. Louisiana's population has also declined And tragically, you know, if you go back to Hurricane Katrina and now Hurricane Ida, you know, much of the parts of Louisiana are certainly not livable anymore. So I do foresee people saying for their own financial health, they want to be in a climatically stable area like Michigan. There's also the, you know, possibility of industrial revival that's happening slowly but surely in the state. And the fact that, you know, under the Biden administration, relations with Canada are certainly going to improve. And we are trading more with Canada and more with Mexico right now than we are with China. So you could actually imagine a sort of, you know, soft version of a North American Union coming into play. And of course, what big city is closest to Canada? It's Detroit. So I do see, again, these propitious geographies enjoying some kind of a renaissance. Remember, we do have about, you know, just about 450 million people in North America. And if you look again at the climate models, they will increasingly concentrate in along the area that is today the U.S.-Canada border, whereas for the last 15 years, around the time since the financial crisis, Americans have been moving from north to south, right, from Rust Belt to Sun Belt. In the next 15 years, it's certainly going to reverse because of climate change.
Because most of the borders are permeable across the world, and because so many of them are so artificial in terms of ethnicity and the like, and many of them have been drawn by two countries historically, Britain and France, you say that the real migration issue is going to be emigration. I'm wondering what that means in terms of stability and conflict across the globe as you see it.
Right. Well, indeed, the real immigration problem is emigration for many countries, especially those that are poorly governed, you know, populist, nationalist countries. Well, let me give you an example. When Matteo Salvini, who is the kind of bombastic head of the five-star movement in Italy, you know, made his pontifications about how, you know, women should stay at home and make babies and, you know, Italy should not have migrants, but just produce more, you know, its own native population. Do you know what happened after that? Italian women left the country, right? They said, we don't want to live under a tyrannical, feudal guy like this. And when you look at, you know, the nationalism of the Erdogan government in Turkey, obviously Putin in Russia, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Modi in India, do you know what these countries have in common? The ones that we hold up as the poster child children of, you know, kind of strongman nationalism. I'll tell you what they have in common. Every young person wants to get the hell out of those countries. So how can we literally paint their people with the same brush as their governments and say, look at this rise of nationalism, you know, the world is going in a totally isolationist direction. In fact, these are the countries that encourage emigration. They're losing their youth. They're losing their lifeblood of talent because their governments are so bad. And that's the reality of the world today. It's, you know, if you really want to know who the winners and losers are in the 21st century, it is so, so simple. Just look at where young people go. Literally follow young people as they vote with their feet. And I can give you so many complex models around how the future will play out. But at the end of the day, it literally does boil down to this.
By the way, Parag Khanna is the founder and the managing partner of Future Map, a global strategic advisory firm that looks to work with governments that are far-sighted in companies. And he's got some remarkable products that are used to map what he's talking about today. You call this generation move. There's strong evidence of aspirational young people, millennials and older Gen Zers, particularly whom you call footloose. Where are they going right now?
So that's exactly right. And, you know, a couple of things on this. First of all, people talk about, you know, the so-called death of the city because of the pandemic and, you know, people fleeing New York and Los Angeles and looking for cheaper places to live. So, you know, that's true. And it doesn't mean the city is dead, right? One city's loss is another's gain. So Denver, Colorado, or Raleigh, North Carolina, Austin, as we mentioned before, you know, Seattle, Boise, Idaho is thriving. And Berlin, you know, what I do is I profile these cities that are kind of the hotbeds for young talent. If you go to Tbilisi, Georgia today in the Caucasus, you'll find as you walk the streets that American English is like the lingua franca, right? There's so many expat young kids and millennials there. I was just in Dubai a couple of weeks ago, and you wouldn't believe how many young people have taken up the golden visa. If you go to Athens or Lisbon today, Athens and Lisbon are the hotspots for digital nomads, creative types from Europe and from America. So this is a reminder that there's plenty of places that are livable and lovely and low tax and, thriving and attracting young people. And I'm very glad that young people who have the skills can operate in this marketplace, this geographical marketplace, where they can choose where they feel most at home, where they can have the best run rate for their savings, and find a sense of community. And we should actually celebrate that and encourage that, because, the next generation, today's young people are not going to wind up the way we did, which is to say the typical person in the world is not, husband and wife with two children living in a suburb in a two-income household, with a home that they own. If you could describe the median human being in the world today, that person would be young, that person would be single, that person would have no children, they would be living in a city, they'd be struggling financially. That's what the typical person in the world is today. So if you want to give advice to young people, don't tell them that they should just quote unquote be like us and grow up and, get a huge mortgage on their heads and buy a home that's too big for what they need in a place where there may not be jobs for them 10 years from now. That's not good advice for today's kids. When I look at them exercising their kind of survival instinct and getting trailer homes and driving around to wherever the work is and gathering experiences, I say go for it. I say absolutely go for it. Be free, be mobile. And that's maybe among the most important skill sets you can have today, is just to be mobile.
What about the notion that you can live anywhere today if you have the skills and you can still be employed by a company half a world away? What is the impact of that?
Well, that's extremely important. So that's, you can either stay at home where you are if you're in a livable place and work remotely for anyone, anywhere, or because if you're working from home, even if your company is down the street, they don't know what you're doing during the day. So you could potentially have two jobs. I've literally hired people who I know have full-time jobs at multinational corporations, but they're good at what they do. They get their work done without having to go to the office in half the day. And then they work for me the other half the day. So the super talented people are earning double incomes right now. On the other hand, there is now a global competition. And that means that, there's a wonderful quote that sums it up perfectly by Simon Cooper from the Financial Times. He says, if you can do your job anywhere, it means that someone anywhere can do your job. And it could mean that you are an American software engineer and you've got your A game and you think you're at the top of the heap, but your job just went to a guy in India who's never left India, because all he has to do is code as well as you and he'll do the job at half the price. So that's also what's happening right now. There's definitely a rising competition globally for digital talent, especially if a company is sort of cloud-based, right, or cloud-first, where it doesn't really matter where you live at all in the first place.
We've got a lot of American young people, intelligent, well-educated, who listen to this podcast and other podcasts. And, of course, they're thinking about their future. You talk about the next American dream. And it all seems like such a swirl. Get out of some of those hot places along the coast if you can. Make certain that you are ready to move if necessary. You talk about the era of 3D printed micro housing at hand, about Amazon selling some of these homes online for $2,000. And you really wonder, what is the next American dream? What recommendation would someone as tied in and tuned in as you are would give somebody listening to this podcast about their own futures?
Well, the first is, that characterization of the American dream and how different it is from our conventional notion. So, we talked about this just a second ago, but in bits and pieces, the full picture is this. The new American dream should not simply be a college degree and a home, right? It should be mobility and skills. And mobility means physical mobility and socioeconomic mobility. But physical mobility is the pathway to those things. A lot of Americans have been stuck in the place. They can't afford to move to places where they would actually get better jobs and earn more money. And that's the irony, because if you can't afford to move, then you can't afford to have that, achieve that benefit of what moving brings. And then the second part of it is the skills, right? So, right now, in fact, it's a perfect timing for us to be talking about this, because some data just came out yesterday about how college enrollment has absolutely plummeted. You know, we have never seen in 50 or more years this rate of decline in college enrollment in America. Mm. Because some places were terrible at remote work and distance learning, kids didn't want to pay, you know, that much money for it. And on the other hand, digital opportunities in parallel have sprung up that are much cheaper. So people are saying, well, why don't I just directly learn my skills through various online platforms? There are many, many, many causes of this, but I think that it really is a sign that young people don't necessarily want to invest in, you know, 4 years of an education per se without knowing what they're going to do with it. I think that, you know, when I say that the new American dream should be mobility and skills, the skills part is constantly acquire skills and go to where you need to go to get those skills or visit whatever online platforms you need to visit to acquire those skills, but never stop learning skills and using them as you're learning them. And in a way, if you look at the Canadian educational system, especially universities like Waterloo, what they do is that you alternate one semester studying, one semester working. And they have a huge office that you know, sort of is always finding internships for every student based upon what they're studying and what their major is and so forth. And that way you really graduate knowing what you want to do and already having a good track record. We need to do a lot more of that in America.
By the way, to parallel what you were saying about college enrollment, I'm reading also some screaming headlines in The Atlantic and other publications about men not going to college. And, of course, we've had this boy crisis in America for a long time where they're just not competing and they're just not academically up to par with women today. Is that something you're seeing worldwide?
Well, in a way, yes. And I don't want to, you know, compare our society to like Arab countries, but it is one of the striking things and ironies about sort of, you know, misogynistic societies of the Middle East that you have a higher rate of female enrollment in universities than you do men. Part of it obviously owes to the fact that you've had a lot of conflicts and so men have been conscripted into war and that kind of thing. But, you know, that paints such a devastating kind of shell-shocked picture of society. But yeah, you know, it is unfortunate that men have been, you know, sort of the first to drop out, you know, or to not pursue economic or educational opportunities in the U.S. Again, I think we can turn it around by creating the right offerings, right? You know, if you don't change the supply side of the equation, right? What are you actually offering? What useful educational opportunities are you offering and where are you offering them and what sort of areas or fields or professions? Then you can't expect the situation to change on the demand side, which is to say these young men to suddenly say, oh yeah, I want to go to school, right? So we've got to work really hard at this.
You do point out that there's, one future, four scenarios. The four scenarios, and by the way, you have to get this book because it will be a reference to you as you're thinking about the world today and the inexorable movement among countries, within countries, and what your future looks like. But you talk about regional fortresses, which closely resemble today's status quo, the new Middle Ages, barbarians at the gate, and Northern Lights, which is large-scale resettlement. So when you go from low migration and then more migration in those four scenarios, what do you see most likely occurring, perhaps for the United States or North America, let's say?
It's a great question. It's a bit of a trick question because, in truth, in as much as we might want to say that, oh, yes, I really hope that North America pursues this Northern Lights scenario in which we have a peaceful recirculation and resettlement of people into climate stable zones and that we do so in a very sustainable way. Of course, that's my aspiration in the book for the whole world, but it's also probably the least likely of the four scenarios. And yet it's also happening in a place like Canada, right? Again, Canada takes in 400,000 people every single year and all of them are on a pathway to citizenship and they're glad that they landed there, you know, more or less. But at the same time, we have, look at the border right now with Mexico. We actually have a so-called barbarians at the gate scenario playing out. And then we also have this new Middle Ages of just survivalism. If you look at people in New Orleans right now after Hurricane Ida, if you look at people in California and elsewhere after forest fires have swept through, you know, they're on their own. They're devastated. You know, they're not getting the kind of support that they need to rebuild and survive. So right now in North America, all of these scenarios are happening. Right. You know, you have the Northern Lights, you have the New Middle Ages, you have the barbarians at the gate, and you have the regional fortress, which is to say we are making investments in our own sustainability and energy self-sufficiency. And we're somewhat sharing it with other countries, but we're not really letting in a lot of migrants. So, you know, what does this tell you? Well, across the whole world, all of these scenarios are happening at the same time. And in the future, they will continue to be there. The only question is to what degree, which scenario is playing out, you know, which part of the world. And that's the way scenarios work. They all have to be true at the same time.
In closing, you say for billions of people, billions, staying put means inevitable suicide. And then you replace the doomsday clock that many of us have grown up with in terms of the potential for nuclear war with the climate clock, and that is ticking. So as you look at it, what do you see just ahead for so many people across the globe?
The thing is, when it comes to the doomsday clock, you know, for example, it makes it seem like climate change is, you know, of course, it's a global phenomenon, but that it affects everyone equally. And the trouble is that it doesn't, right? You know, the regions of the world that are, for example, you know, parts of South America, Africa, Middle East, South Asia are going to be more affected and are devastated by climate change versus other regions. And it's already happening today. You know, look at Bangladesh, look at the Maldives, you know, look at the droughts and the 0-day events where cities have no water, like in Senegal, Cape Town, South Africa. This happened in Sao Paulo, in Chennai, India, all in the last couple of years. Whereas in the northern hemisphere, you don't have as much, you know, sort of climate impact. You have climate change and you have heat waves still, and you know, but it's not nearly as dire as you have in many other parts of the world. And this is, again, the most profound irony that is, in a way, one of the points of departure for the book is that we have, you know, 8 billion people coming up on eventually maybe 9 billion people, but maximum 9 billion people. And the countries and the regions of the world that are becoming the most livable and greener on the map as climate change accelerates, you know, parts like, you know, places like Europe, Canada, Russia, are depopulating. So imagine a map of the world where all the resources and food and abundance and, you know, fresh air and water are in places that have fewer and fewer people. And the majority of the human population is in red zones, places that are getting hotter and drier and unlivable. But because of today's political borders and kind of myopia, you know, they're basically, you know, left to rot. And that's literally the situation we're in right now. We have these badly misaligned geographies. And you know, no one is going to fix this for us, right? The United Nations is not going to fix this. The Biden administration is not going to fix this for the world. China is not going to fix this. We need to think about this. We need to literally look at a map that shows how misaligned the geography of resources and people are, and to think about what we should do right now in this next 10, 20 years to fix that problem, because literally the fate of our species does, in fact, depend on it.
Remarkable book, remarkable presenter, remarkable man, Parag Khanna. The book is called Move, Get It, The Forces Uprooting Us. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Such a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you.